Patience, our hearts be always acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our strength and our redeemer.
Amen.
Please be seated. Well, in today's gospel, we have the great commandments. This is Luke's presentation of this. My hearing aids just did it again. I'm sorry, but they just decided there is a Bluetooth somewhere out there that needs to connect to this. Come on. Thank you. Sorry about that. Anyway, this is Luke's presentation of the Great Commandments. And in Luke, in Matthew and Mark, Jesus is the one who presents them. In Luke, Luke is confronted by a lawyer, and he asks, what is the greatest commandment? And Jesus turns it around and says, well, what do you read? What do you think? You tell me. And he presents the great commandments to Jesus. And that's fine. He does a good job. Do this and you will live, Jesus says. But then the lawyer isn't satisfied. He is desiring, quote, to justify himself and said to Jesus, and who is my neighbor? I've been working on this sermon for the last couple of weeks. It has been hard. This sermon has really challenged me to the core of my being, and I, to be honest with you, I've shed a lot of tears in the preparation of this sermon. I prayerfully looked at this parable from various perspectives. I looked at it from the perspective of the priest, then from the Levite, then from the Samaritan. I looked at it from the standpoint of the victim. I looked at it from the standpoint of the innkeeper. But I found that I was most uncomfortably identifying with the Lord's questioner. I wanted to justify myself and my lack of mercy and my inability to show compassion. And I felt truly convicted by the Lord. And then the Lord, in the midst of all of this and my crying, he asked me a very simple question. Bill, who is your Samaritan? Not who is your neighbor, but who is your Samaritan? Let me remind you of who the Samaritans are. When Israel, the northern kingdom, was overrun by the Assyrians in 722 BC, they dispersed all the Jews. The 10 tribes of Israel were dispersed throughout the world, but a few of them remained. The poorest of the poor were kept by the Assyrians to take care of the land, to harvest the crops, essentially. And they sent people from some of the occupied territories around there to come and to work with them. And they intermarried, and they became half-breeds. They were no longer Jews in the pure sense of the word because they were intermarrying with others. And so Samaritan became synonymous with somebody who was unclean. And in John chapter 4, when Jesus is passing through Samaria, he comes to a woman at Jacob's well and he asks her for water. And it says that the woman was just dumbfounded by him, a Jew, asking her, a Samaritan, for water. And John says, for the Jews have no dealings with Samaritans. So the question then became, whom do I choose to avoid? With whom do I wish to have no dealings? Who is my Samaritan? And when Jesus asked who was neighbor to the other, the lawyer answered, he didn't say it was the Samaritan. He wouldn't even utter the name. He said the one who showed mercy. surely it couldn't have been a Samaritan, because we know Samaritans are no good. He wouldn't even utter the name Samaritan. So when Jesus asked who was neighbor to the other, what Jesus said to the lawyer was, go and do likewise. Go and show mercy. Go, have compassion on the least, the lost, the lonely. Go and support those who are unable to support themselves. The good Samaritan in this parable experienced a broken heart. He was filled with mercy for somebody he didn't even know, for somebody who was dying on the side of the road. His heart was broken. Mercy is a matter of the heart. And he put that merciful heart to action. And he showed compassion on the one who was the victim in this story. And the word compassion, my friends, look at that word. Calm, with, passion, suffering. That Samaritan was willing to suffer with the one who had been beaten. He went over, he ministered to his needs, he put him on his donkey, he carried him to an inn, he paid for a room, he took care of that injured man, and he even went so far as to give money to the innkeeper so that the innkeeper could do more for him. He suffered with the one who was suffering. So what is it, my friends, that breaks the heart of Jesus? And then ask yourself, can I allow my heart to be broken with what breaks the heart of Jesus? This is what the Lord is calling us to do in this parable, to go and do likewise, to suffer with those who are suffering, to have mercy in our hearts and to show compassion. James in chapter 2, verse 13 of his epistle even puts it even more tightly for us, more clear. He says, judgment is without mercy. Whoa, the judgment of God is without mercy to one who has shown no mercy. Oh. Now, I went from preaching to meddling real fast, didn't it? So think about it. When we cry out in the Kyrie, Lord, have mercy upon us. Christ, have mercy upon us. Lord, have mercy upon us. Do we show mercy to those who need mercy? In Matthew chapter 5, verse 7, in the Beatitudes, Jesus said, blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. They shall be shown mercy. The merciful shall be shown mercy. And of course, every time we say the Lord's Prayer, we set the example for our Lord. Forgive us our trespasses. Oh Lord, please have mercy upon me. Forgive me for my sins. Forgive me for my trespasses, just as I have forgiven others. Forgiven others their trespasses against me. We set the standard. Mercy is a matter of heartbroken things that break God's heart. And compassion flows from that mercy as we willingly suffer with those who suffer. Let me give you three examples. Two secular examples and one biblical example here. All right. This today, July 13th, 2025, is the 40th anniversary of Live Aid. Anybody old enough to remember Live Aid? All right, yeah. Okay. Amazing, amazing event. For those of you who don't know about Live Aid, actually, you can find out tonight. CNN is going to be broadcasting the BBC documentary about Live Aid starting at 9 o'clock tonight on CNN. There'll be 2 hours tonight, 2 hours next Sunday, and for 4 Sundays in a row at 9 o'clock. Anyway, but I don't want to talk about Live Aid. I want to talk about what prompted Live Aid. And you'll see that. Do they know it's Christmas time at all? Okay. Yeah, that really is a 45. You know, one of those vinyl things. Has flip sides.
Big hole in the middle.
What's that?
Big hole in
the middle. And a big hole in the middle. That's right. Exactly.
It doesn't mean it's holy.
All right. Anyway. Bob Geldof, who was the lead singer for Boomtown Rats, an Irish band, he and his, at that time, girlfriend, later wife, Paula Yates, were watching a BBC documentary on the famine in Ethiopia. This was in October of 1984. And he just was overcome by the pictures, and specifically one nurse. There were 10,000 refugees out there in this camp, and they were all literally dying of starvation, and she had enough food to feed 300 of them. And so she had to go through the camp and pick the ones who were most likely to benefit from being able to get some food. And she picked 300 and took them and fed them, and the other 9,700 were left to die. And that knocked Bob Geldof on his hiney. And he called his friend Midge Ure, who's the lead singer for Ultravox, and he told him about it, and he said, Paula and I really want to do something, but what can we do in the face of this? And the two of them got together, and they decided, what are we good at? We're good at music, so why don't we make a record and sell the record and give the proceeds to help feed the poor, to help feed those who are starving in Ethiopia. And he knew that there was more to it than just the two of them getting together. And so he got on the phone and he started calling. And the first person he called was Sting, and he said, hey, here's what I'm thinking about. And Sting said, yeah, we need to get everybody on board. And he started calling, and all but three of the musicians that he called immediately said, yes, let's do this, okay? And so Midge Ure and Bob Geldof got together. They wrote a song. Do they know it's Christmas time at all? And on November 24th, they all got together. 37 musicians, 37 egos, think about this, got together on November 24th, and in one day, made that recording. And they got commitments from the labels to support this. There were others who were there, producers, technicians. They all got together, and they produced this record in record time. And it was released on December 7th. And Jack, are you ready? Christopher, are you ready? I want to play this for you, just so you can hear what they came up with on such short notice. Ready?
It's Christmas time. There's no need to be afraid. At Christmas time, we let the moon and we vanish shade. In our world of plenty, we can spend a night. Throw your arms around the world. But pray for the other one to come at Christmas time. But when you're having fun, there's no one outside your window.
You could see from that there's a lot of Christian imagery in that song. Bob Geldof is an avowed atheist. So somebody asked him, "Why you?" And his answer, "God looked down from heaven and chose the least likely." That record was number one on the British charts for 3 weeks running. It was sold around the world. They did a massive printing of it. And by December 31st of 1984, they had raised $178 million. God got a hold of Bob Geldof and broke his heart. And he was filled with mercy. And he was moved not only to pray or to do whatever, but he was moved to suffer with those who were suffering. He had true compassion for those who were in Ethiopia. But I had to ask myself, okay, I bought this in December of 1984. Miranda and I contributed to the Presiding Bishop's Fund for World Relief of the Episcopal Church. But I just had to ask myself again as I was looking at this. Were they Samaritans to me? Did I want to have anything to do with them? Or did I want to avoid dealing with them and sending a check was easier than being involved? What is it that breaks God's heart? Does it break mine? Okay. Let me give you a second secular example. Father Peter Insor is Christopher's godfather. Was. He died 3 years ago. He was a good friend of mine as well. when he was a newly ordained priest in Massachusetts. I believe it was Massachusetts. Anyway, God got a hold of him and broke his heart with what was going on in the Deep South. When Miranda and I were driving from Montgomery into Selma and then back again from Selma into Montgomery a couple weeks ago, we were taking note of the campsites along the way between Selma and Montgomery on the march that took place in March of 1965. Father Peter Insor made that march with Martin Luther King. When you go down that road, about halfway down is the Lowndes Interpretive Center, which is a place where you can go and learn all about the march and all about things that were going on in 1965, especially for the black community there. You realize blacks had no right to vote. In Lowndes County, Alabama, there were over 10,000 residents in that county in 1965. There were 2,240 who were registered to vote, and all of them were white. That broke the heart of Father Peter Insor, and he got a couple of other Episcopal priests. They got into a car, and a 1960 Falcon, and drove from Massachusetts to Selma, Alabama, and they marched with Dr. Martin Luther King and the thousands of others who made that march. He chose to suffer with those who were suffering, and he marched. I had to ask myself, as we were making that drive, Miranda and I were making the drive, would I have done that? Would I have marched? Would I have been willing to suffer with them? Or were the blacks at that time Samaritans to me? Let me give you a third example. This one is from the scriptures itself. It was no accident that the book of Ruth was my Old Testament reading this week in the Liturgy of the Hours. Ruth wasn't a Samaritan. No, she was much worse. She was a Moabitess. Now, I've told you about the Samaritans. Don't forget about who the Moabites were. In Genesis chapter 19, when God destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, he spared Lot. And when they came, when Lot and his family came out, they were going to go to Zoar, but he was so scared, he took his two daughters, and they went and hid in a cave. And they must have been there a very long time, because the two daughters were despairing of ever having a man in their lives, ever having children. And so the two daughters conspired together. They got their father drunk, and the oldest one laid with him and got pregnant. Then the next night, they got him drunk again, and the younger one laid with their father and got pregnant. The oldest daughter's son was named Moab. He was the son of an incestuous relationship. Absolutely abhorrent to Jews. Well, Ruth was a Moabite. She was a descendant of Moab. But how did she come into this story at all? Well, you see, Elimelech and Naomi, two Jews who were living in Judea at the time, not at the time of Lot and all that, this is much later, at the time of Ruth, okay, there was a famine that hit Judea, and they fled, the two of them, Elimelech and Naomi, fled to Moab, where there was food. And they stayed there for a period of time, they and their two sons. Well, after a while, Elimelech died, and the two sons ended up marrying Moabite women. Orpah, not Oprah, Orpah and Ruth. They married, and those are the two wives, okay? Well, then the two sons died, okay? And after a while, Naomi heard tell that the famine had ended and she could go back home. And so she started to head out. And the two daughter-in-laws wanted to go with her, but she tried to convince them both to stay, that they would not really be very welcome in Judea because they were Moabites. And Ruth insisted on going with Naomi. Orpah went back. Well, after they got to Judea, there really wasn't anything that Ruth could do, so she went out to take gleanings from the field. Well, that was a very dangerous thing for a single woman to do. And Boaz, who was a relative of Naomi, saw this and invited her to come into his field and instructed all of his workers to not touch this woman and offer her protection. Okay? After a period of time, Naomi got to the place where she knew that she was going to have to pass on, and so she put her property out for her next of kin and said, you can have this property. And she thought it was Boaz, but Boaz said, no, there's somebody ahead of me, next of kin. And so property was offered to him, and he said, yeah, absolutely, I'll take it. And then Boaz said, but you also have to have Ruth as your wife. Ooh, she's a Moabite. Ain't no way I'm going to do that. Absolutely no. I don't want the property. Thank you very much. And so Boaz took the property and Ruth as his wife. That put him in a place where he was going to be the subject of much ridicule for having a Moabite wife. But he was willing to suffer with her. His mercy, his compassion, convinced him that this woman was worth doing this for. And Ruth gave birth to Obed. Obed was the father of Jesse. And Jesse was the father of David. King David. She's the great-grandmother of the king of Israel, a Moabite. And lest you think that's the end of the story, Boaz is of the tribe of Judah. His ancestor was the son of Judah, Perez. And who is Perez's mother? Say? No. Tamar, who was Judah's daughter-in-law. Oh my God, here we go again. That's abhorrent. And so we've got a Moabite who is the great-grandmother of David on the one side, and Perez on the other side, and don't forget that David is also the ancestor of, through Mary, Jesus Christ. So why would God even allow this to happen? In Romans chapter 15, in verse 4, Paul tells us, whatever was written in former days was written for our instruction. God is instructing us on how we are to treat the least, the lost, the lonely, the despised, the Moabites, the Samaritans. He is teaching us how these break his heart And he wants our hearts to be broken with what breaks his heart. He is teaching us how to suffer with the ones who are suffering. Well, Father Chris has been challenging us for many weeks now about evangelism. To whom will we go? To whom will we go? Who are my neighbors? Even more importantly, who are my Samaritans? Who are the ones that I want to avoid? Who are the ones with whom I want no dealings whatsoever? You might want to raise them up to first on the list. And I would challenge you too, my brothers and sisters, to pray. To pray that Jesus will break our hearts with the things that break his. Lord, fill my heart with mercy that I may show compassion and suffer with those who are suffering. Amen.